Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in German Studies. I'm Craig Servillo, the host of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Dr. Stephen Remy about his excellent new book, The Malmedy Massacre, The War Crimes Trial Controversy, published by Harvard in 2017. Dr. Remy, hello and welcome to the show.
It's great to be here.
Great to have you. Dr. Remy, we'd like to begin these interviews by having you tell us something about yourself.
I'm originally from the Midwest. I studied international relations when I was an undergraduate and had a strong interest in history and developed a particular interest in the 20th century and the Cold War. And after I graduated, I joined the Peace Corps. And when I came back, I moved to Washington, D.C., and I worked for a think tank, the Atlantic Council, which was kind of the unofficial representative of NATO in the United States. And it was a bipartisan think tank. And there I was very fortunate. I got to interact on a regular basis with a number of people who had played a direct role in the Cold War, really from start to finish, people like Paul Mitza and Roseanne Ridgway and Madeleine Albright, and it was an extraordinary experience. And after a few years, I decided that I wanted to enter graduate work in the history of the Cold War, and I went to the Contemporary History Institute at Ohio University. I specifically wanted to work with John Gaddis, and he supervised my master's thesis. And I got very lucky because my interests were really turning to modern German history. And when John Gaddis went to Yale, there was still really an extraordinary lineup of historians at the Institute at Ohio. My mentor, Jeffrey Herf, Norman Goda, Stephen Miner, scholar of modern Russian history. So I was very fortunate. I had a really terrific experience there and wrote my dissertation on the Nazification and denazification of Heidelberg University, which became my first book.
Oh, fascinating. John Gaddis is he's a legend in that field. He's written some great books about the Cold War. Now, specifically to your book, how did you become interested in the Malmedy trial? How did this book come about?
It was a couple of things. I had been doing research for a number of years on the experiences of Jewish refugees from Nazi Germany who came to the United States and then joined the U.S. Army and then went back to the European theater and went back to Germany. And in the 2000s, I had embarked on a project in which I was trying to locate as many as I could and record interviews with them, knowing that it was getting to be about the last chance to do that. And I had collected a little over 20 interviews with men of that generation, that profile. They were nearly all men. One woman, Hannah Wardenberg. I also interviewed the sociologist Hannah Wardenberg. But my intention originally was to write a book about their experiences. And a colleague of mine, Benjamin Heth, a historian Benjamin Heth, asked me if I had ever heard the name William Pearl. And I hadn't. He was deceased at the time, but I had never heard his name and looked into it and found out that he had been the chief interrogator, one of the chief investigators in the Malmedy massacre investigation and case. And I'd heard of the Malmedy massacre, of course, but I didn't know that much about the case and about the controversy, and I looked into it, and it was one of those things that it just got its hooks in me. The story itself just really grabbed me, and one of the things that grabbed me about it was that since it dealt, the controversy involved accusations of torture and mistreatment by American interrogators, it had this very contemporary resonance to me. And I had been, spent a lot of time talking to Jewish refugee veterans. Many of them, most of them, had been interrogators at one point, either during the war or after the war in war crimes trial investigations. And I was interviewing them at the time that the Abu Ghraib scandal was breaking out, and a big debate in the United States over interrogation methods. And so there was a contemporary, really, I felt there was a really contemporary resonance there. And finally, the last reason is in the Malmedy massacre, I pick up a theme that I had worked on in the Heidelberg Myths, and that's what I call the untangling of modern German history. And what I mean by that is that a lot of what we know or think we knew about post-war Germany, post-World War II Germany, had been shaped or influenced in various ways by former Nazis and those who sympathized with them. And if you look at different professional fields, for instance, medicine in Germany, the legal profession, as you know, the entire the history of the German Foreign Office is another good example. The controversy over the Reichstag fire that, again, my colleague Benjamin Head has written about so brilliantly. The Malmedy case fits into that category. I discovered in that a lot of what we knew about the case, the investigation, the trial, the controversy had been shaped by, influenced by former Nazis or those who sympathized with him, and not just Germans, also Americans. So that became a big driver of my interest in the case.
Fascinating. Yeah, I want to ask you again in a little bit about the sympathizers, particularly on the American side. But before we get there, can you just give our listeners who are not familiar with the massacre itself some sort of background onto what the event is, how it took place? Just a couple of minutes of background.
Sure. What becomes known as the Malmedy massacre took place on the second day of a surprise German counteroffensive into the Ardennes region of southern Belgium, December of 1944, and it becomes known as the Battle of the Bulge, the last important German offensive or counteroffensive of World War II, and it produces it's the costliest intelligence failure in American military history. It produces the deadliest land battle in American military history. The Germans totally surprised, or nearly totally surprised, the Americans. And the German objective was to punch through American lines and capture Antwerp. Antwerp was the most important port on the continent, supplying American and allied British and allied forces after D-Day. There was no way that the Germans were going to reach Antwerp. They didn't have the resources to do it, and the Americans contained the German advance in a bulge shaped, a bulge shape in southern Belgium. The spearhead of the invasion was comprised of Waffen-SS units. The SS, Waffen-SS was the armed forces division of the SS. And on the second day, one of these spearheads encountered a lightly armed group of somewhere around 200 Americans, most of them part of a field artillery observation battalion, near the town of Malmedy. And after a brief firefight, the Americans surrendered. The Germans accepted their surrender and then attempted to kill all of them. This becomes known as the Malmedy massacre, and it becomes instantly famous or infamous in the United States. And that's maybe something we can talk about, the publicity. But then the same German unit, the same Waffen-SS unit, combat group, goes on to kill several hundred more American prisoners of war and Belgian civilians. It's often forgotten that Belgian civilians suffered terribly during the liberation of their country and during the Battle of the Bulge. But this particular incident, December 17th, 1944, 83 or 84 American prisoners of war are executed by elements of this Waffen-SS combat unit, and that's the Malmedy massacre.
Yeah, I do want to follow up on something you said in the background piece. The publicity of the event was sort of extraordinary, and you make this point in the early chapters of your book that the American government particularly had sort of shielded the American public from massacres and war crimes and just general bad images of the war. This is not the case with Malmedy. It's publicized
right.
quickly and widespread.
Yep.
And definitely, and you can confirm this, that it sort of leads particularly to this, you know, specifically to a trial for this massacre. Can you talk about this and why this happened? Why the abrupt change of, I guess, policy, to lack of a better word?
Yeah, by that stage in the war, the War Department and the Office of War Information in the United States was censoring thousands of newspaper stories and newsreel footage and photographs, and it was very rare for the American public to be shown photographs of fallen American soldiers. There had been one important exception published in, I believe, 1941 or 42 in New Guinea. George Strock's famous photograph of fallen Marines in New Guinea, published in Life magazine. That was really rare, and that official taboo, so to speak, was broken again after the Malmedy massacre. And I think Dwight Eisenhower, who was crucial in allowing or encouraging a lightning quick publicity campaign, I think his primary interest was that the news reach American soldiers fighting in Belgium as quickly as possible. And there's good evidence that the publicity had an effect on, had an instantaneous effect on American soldiers, encouraging them to fight with particular tenacity. So I think that was, I've always believed that was Eisenhower's first impulse. But I think that there was a political dimension to this too, to show the American public, especially once the remains of the victims were discovered, about a month after the massacre itself, and there's an incredible two-page spread of large photographs with very little text of some of the victims, and it published in Life magazine in February 1945, and they're very graphic. They're shocking. To this day, they're absolutely shocking to look at. So I think that there may have also been a kind of why we fight impulse driving the Office of War Information's decision to allow the publication of those photographs.
Sure. Yeah. No. That makes perfect sense. And there are photographs in your book that highlight how horrific the massacre was.
Yeah, I reproduce the Life magazine spread in the book.
Yeah. So we have the massacre. The remains are discovered. Obviously, we win the Battle of the Bulge. We ultimately defeat Nazi Germany. So now, preparations are being made for trials. How did this particular event come to trial? What were the immediate steps following the war, or were they preparing for trials even before the war ended? This particular trial before the war even ended.
Yes. Dwight Eisenhower made it clear that he wanted the perpetrators caught and brought to justice. And by that time, by the time of the massacre, the United States government, allied governments were already discussing and making plans for post-war war crimes trials, and the new division of the War Department's judge advocate, there was a new division of the War Department's judge advocate that would be responsible for investigating and prosecuting war crimes trials. And that division made the Malmedy case a top priority. Now, that said, Eisenhower had also decreed that ordered that no war crimes trials take place before the end of hostility, because there was a main issue there was concern for Allied prisoners of war in German hands. So, with one very minor exception, no trials that were held of Germans accused of war crimes before the war ended. So, there's a kind of preliminary investigation that takes place by a joint American-British court, but no full-scale investigation begins really until really begins to pick up steam until the fall of 1945.
And so, what was the prosecution's case? How did they put it together? What evidence did they use? Generally, how did they go about prosecuting the trial?
Yeah, the prosecution was initially focused on just the Malmedy massacre because that's what they had the clearest evidence of, and there was forensic evidence that the bodies had been the bodies of the victims had been recovered. I should add that among the massacres, many massacres committed by the Waffen-SS in both the East and West during World War II, the Malmedy incident was unusual because 50 prisoners of war survived. Survived the initial attempt to kill them, mainly by playing dead in this snow-covered field where they were being where they had been captured and where the execution attempt took place. They played dead and they waited until dark. Some of them were wounded, and they made their way to various American checkpoints, so they were picked up by American patrols. So there was a lot of eyewitness evidence available, and a number of American survivors would testify for the prosecution during the trial. There were intelligence reports, some of them collected by Jewish refugees serving in the American Army who had been trained, specially trained interrogators, about the composition, the personnel of the responsible Waffen-SS combat group. And then as the prosecution, as the investigators investigate, they realize that the Malmedy massacre was only one of multiple war crimes committed by this Waffen-SS unit. It had gone on to kill a number of other American prisoners of war and Belgian civilians. So ultimately, the accused in the case were accused of participation, not just in the Malmedy massacre, but often other war crimes. So to get more specifically to your question, the prosecution was making the case that when Adolf Hitler himself had conceived of this operation, he gave orders to his generals that the Waffen-SS and the German army was to spread a wave of panic and terror among the Americans, the British, and Belgian civilians, and they were to show no mercy. And as was so often the case in Nazi Germany, his subordinates, his generals, and the army and the Waffen-SS did not need to be instructed specifically as to what that meant. A lot of the officers in Waffen-SS responsible for this massacre had a lot of experience fighting in the Soviet Union or in Italy later in the war, and they understood how they were to operate, and I call the way that they operate in the book Terror War, in which the objective of the fighting is not just to achieve this or that concrete objective, but also to spread fear and panic.
Right.
So the prosecution said that. So the prosecution made the claim that Hitler and this started with Hitler, was passed through the ranks, and the Waffen-SS was to take no prisoners, especially shouldn't the conditions really make that really get in the way of their rapid advance. And they operated accordingly.
Sure. So this is a good time to transition into the defendants.
Right.
You give the big picture as to how these units behaved. But who are the principal defendants at this trial? Who are they? How fanatical are they? How did they defend themselves? And so on.
Well, the highest visibility defendant in the trial at the time was an SS general, Josef Sepp Dietrich, went by the name Sepp. And he was one of Hitler's oldest and most loyal generals. He was the figure that most people, they had followed the war, knew something about the German military, they would have recognized that name. For me, though, and I think for most historians, the more fascinating and important defendant at the trial was the commander of the battle group. This battle group was part of the Waffen-SS Leibstandarte Adolf Hitler, which I translate in the book as personal standard. It often gets translated as bodyguard. I think personal standard conveys a bit more of the ceremonial symbolic significance of that particular unit named for Adolf Hitler. And this is Joachim Peiper. Peiper is really, I think, the most fascinating of the defendants. He's somebody that historians have been really interested in. Well, both historians, but also Waffen-SS apologists and neo-Nazis. He remains a very popular figure, and martyred too, because he was murdered in 1976. But those two, Dietrich and Peiper. And especially Peiper, I think, were the most important defendants. Now, the other thing I'll say about the defendants, and one of the things that makes this case interesting, 74 defendants in the trial, they represent a real cross-section of the Waffen-SS. So there's everybody from Sepp Dietrich to the battle group's commander, Joachim Peiper, and then a fairly significant number of non-commissioned officers, and then there are a handful of privates and very young, 17, 18 years old at the time of the incident, men who had been drafted into the Waffen-SS very late in the war. And you asked about ideological conviction. There's no question that Sepp Dietrich and Joachim Peiper and a lot of the NCOs were devoted Nazis. Piper, I think, was as pure a product of the SS as you could find of anywhere. He had been Heinrich Himmler's adjutant. He had fought in France, in Russia, in Italy, and then in the Battle of the Bulge. But you go further down the ranks and younger in age, and I think you see less ideological conviction and more, more fear, I think, and especially among the very young conscripts.
So you make very clear in the book, sort of at the time and even historically up to your book, there were a number of allegations that the defendants were tortured to exact confessions.
Right.
You make very clear in your book that this is a myth. I feel like this point is sort of central to what you're getting at. So I want to kind of take it in two halves. The first is to where does this come from? Where does this myth come from? And how does it become so pervasive and resilient? Years later, decades later, this still being talked about as if it actually happened. So let's start
right.
with that,
right.
and then I'll...
Yeah, in terms of the origins, this goes to the way... The answer to that question goes to the way that the investigation was conducted. The chief interrogator in the investigation was William Pearl. And Pearl was a trained interrogator, and it needs to be mentioned here that during World War II, the United States had created a pretty sophisticated system for training interrogators. And this training facility was at Camp Ritchie in Maryland. It was a strange place. One of the trainees later described it as the strangest place in the United States. And a number of different men of different nationalities trained, as psychological warfare operatives or interrogators or other kinds of intelligence specialties at Camp Ritchie. And they were trained not to use physical force in obtaining information. They were trained to use tricks and ruses, good cop, bad cop routines, those kinds of investigative techniques. And William Pearl was one of them. In fact, he was briefly an instructor at Camp Ritchie. So he has a background as a trained interrogator and an experienced interrogator in the war. And he becomes the chief interrogator in the Mount Mady case. Now, so you have to imagine here, this group of suspects being interrogated, being questioned by a fluent German speaker who seems to know a great deal about their background. And this is one of the things that I learned about the investigation most of it did not involve dramatic cinematic style confrontations in a cell. Most of it involved a grind of compiling information. And the interrogators assumed that the more that they knew about the unit and the suspects in question, the better able they would be to conduct productive interrogations. So they very often surprised people with how much information that they knew about the different parts of this Waffen-SS unit, nicknames, personal grudges, details about very minute details about the operations there in the Ardennes. So it was often easy to convince a suspect that the interrogators knew more than they might have actually known, and this was essential to getting information. Now, they obtained confessions. The interrogators obtained written confessions, and I think that the defendants, in the, ultimately, when the trial began, shortly before the trial began, were shocked to discover that dozens of their comrades had informed on each other, had accused each other of committing crimes, given eyewitness testimony of crimes being committed. And that was quite a shock. And shortly before the trial began, a few claimed to the defense team, which was led by an American and comprised also of some German defense lawyers, that they had been abused. And the chief defense lawyer, Colonel, U.S. Army Colonel Willis Everett, properly brought the matter to the attention of higher authorities, and one of the first of many investigations into the allegations was conducted, and the accusations were found to be baseless. So all of this, remember, takes place before the trial. And only a few of the defendants during the trial claim that they had been physically abused. So after the trial, during the controversy, the prosecutors would be banging their head against the wall, trying to get what they thought was the obvious point across, which was, look, if the defendants had been tortured, the time to have brought that out was in the trial itself, not later. So why does anybody believe what these people are saying? So that's where it starts. It starts with the defendants themselves. You asked how it became so pervasive and so resilient. That's a complicated issue. I think there's two things going on. One is there is an attempt by the convicted men and their supporters to overturn, challenge the sentences, and to overturn the verdicts and get the convicted men released from prison. The convicted men want this. Their supporters want that. That is a number of German lawyers, a number of prominent German clergymen. And there is also an American dimension to this. It starts with the chief defense attorney, Willis Everett. He loses the trial badly. He's facing the prospect of returning to his struggling law firm in Atlanta, Georgia, and professional obscurity. And he thinks that he's got an incredible story here. And there's some evidence that Everett had it in his mind that this story was going to make him rich and famous. It's possible that he envisioned the story being bought by Hollywood and Hollywood making a war crimes trial version of 12 Angry Men or Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, and his character would be played by Henry Fonda or Jimmy Stewart. I think that there's a publicity seeking element to this by Willis Everett. Now, there's another factor too with Everett, and that is that Everett, like a significant number of American occupation officials, sympathized with the defeated Germans, not their victims. And in Everett's case, sympathized very strongly with the men in the Malmedy case, particularly Joachim Peiper. Peiper could speak English. He was charismatic. His wife, Sigurd, had been one of Heinrich Himmler's personal secretaries. That's how Joachim Peiper and Sigurd met and married. She remained a very active advocate for her convicted husband. And I think Everett was sympathetic. And I think one other point about Everett that needs to be made, by Everett's own admission, Everett was a proud man of the American South. He described himself as a rebel. And I think that there was something about the occupation of Germany that resonated with him as an American Southerner. And I don't want to stereotype Americans in the South and take that too far, but we have it by his own admission, Everett describing himself in those terms. So I think that plays a role there.
Sure, and this is a good transition because I want to ask you about. There's a wide network of people that are involved in sympathizing with these guys. It's a matter of great interest not only for elites in legal circles or in government circles, mm-hmm. but for ordinary Germans as well. And Americans, because it does cross the pond and becomes an issue of importance here. So what is their argument? How do they disseminate it? And how effective is it with ordinary people?
Well, their argument takes a couple of forms. One is general, related to the war and the occupation, and another is specific to the Malmedy case. And the general argument in defense of the defendants, the convicted men, is that this trial, and like other war crimes trials, were instances of victor's justice. Okay? So to put it in the simplest terms, the argument was that, well, look, the British, the Americans, the Russians, they won the war, so of course they were going to hold these trials. And as lawyers, clergymen, army and German army and SS veterans, as they would state repeatedly about this and other cases, they pointed out that, look, the Soviets in particular were responsible. Well, first of all, they were partly responsible for starting the war. Okay, nobody wants to talk about this in 1945, 46, 47, but that it was the case. And then they committed many of the kinds of crimes that Germans are now being held responsible for. Another argument was that the Allies were leveling a charge of collective guilt at all Germans, which wasn't in fact the case, but was part of this argument that I think is one that had to have resonated strongly with ordinary Germans, even if you weren't active in opposing war crimes trials. Specifically to the Malmedy case was a couple of things. One, there was acceptance of the defense's position at the trial this was a heat of battle case. All right. I mean, at the trial, the defense could not get around the fact that something happened in this tiny rural crossroads in Belgium, and it's pretty clear that it was a war crime, or it could easily be appear to be that way. So the defense said, look, that this wasn't premeditated. There was no there was no order to spread terror and panic and kill prisoners of war and civilians. This was just, it was a heat of battle case. And that kind of thing, heat of battle conditions could affect any soldier in any war. So this is a tragedy. It's terrible. It's not a war crime. So that argument was picked up after the war. Then finally, of course, there were the torture accusations, which Willis Everett, among a few others, was trying to disseminate in the United States to anybody who would listen, to the army, of course, but also to the press. The supporters of the convicted men in Germany, particularly two clergymen, one in the Catholic Church and one in the Protestant Church, two of Germany's most prominent clergymen, were convinced that the defendants had been abused horribly. What I'll add to that is that in 1947 and in 1948, some of the convicted men, with the assistance of prison clergy and their lawyers, began writing affidavits describing in gruesome detail what the Americans had done to them. And this was really gruesome stuff. Broken bones and crushed testicles and smashed teeth. And I don't think there was a single important American official who took any of that seriously. You read it now and it sounds like a hack screenwriter's attempt at dramatizing torture. But they were prepared as legal documents, as affidavits, and then they were, they got wide publicity both in Western Germany and in the United States. So many Germans, it took those accusations at face value. And the last thing I'll add to this is that there were ways for the convicted men's supporters to convey that some of the principal investigators had been Jews, had been Jewish refugees from Nazi Germany. Now, they had to be very careful in the language that they used. They could not use overt anti-Semitic language. But terms like avenging angels and recent Americans is one that appears both in the American and German context. And it did not take much imagination to figure out what those references meant by that. What it meant was Jewish revenge. The Jews had come back to Germany and were now taking revenge on the helpless, defeated Germans.
I mean, so you make clear in the book that all of these allegations are completely false, fabricated. There were no confirmable instances of torture, correct?
I do make that case, yes. Now, it is clear that in a few cases, one or more investigators lost his temper. People were, in some cases, were shouted at, perhaps slapped or shoved. But the accusations leveled by the convicted men themselves and then disseminated by their supporters, I contend are absolutely baseless. And you know, one of the things I did in research for the book is in the National Archives outside Washington, in records related to this and other war crimes, trials conducted by the Army, there are thousands and thousands of pages of interrogation transcripts. Not reports of interrogations, but actual transcripts. And I reproduced part of one of them at some length. It takes a few pages in the book, but I wanted to convey something, and that is that this isn't like an episode of 24. I mean, they're almost unbearably boring to read them, which is interesting. They mostly, what the interrogators are doing is what I mentioned earlier, is that they're trying to compile information, which may or may not include a confession of responsibility or guilt. But it's fascinating. There are moments of drama. You can find them in these interrogation transcripts, but they're few and far between. And they bear no resemblance, absolutely no resemblance to what the convicted men, how the convicted men described the conditions of their interrogations.
Yeah, I just wanted you to elaborate on that because I feel like it's such an important part of the book, and I want all the listeners to understand they made these accusations, but they were baseless, and the reasons behind that. So I want to shift gears a little bit, and I want to ask you about how the changing sort of political situations in Europe, mostly the Cold War, sort of impacted this trial and its aftermath.
Yeah. Well, I think 1949 is definitely a turning point for the fate of convicted war criminals. That's the by the end of the year, two German states had come into existence, and of course this didn't happen overnight. This had been building up for some time. A division of the country into two separate states. I mean, this was a very complicated legal and diplomatic matter, of course, and one of the complicating factors is the fate of convicted war criminals who, in Germany, in Western Germany, remain under the purview or the control of either the French or the British or the Americans, even after the establishment of two separate states, of a West German state, a Federal Republic of Germany. For the first couple of years of its existence, the Federal Republic was not entirely sovereign. There was a high commissioner, an Allied high commissioner, and John McCoy was the most famous of them in West Germany. But one of the high commissioner's responsibilities was the fate of Germans convicted by the Allies in the Nuremberg trials and in the different zonal trials. And this was a huge deal for Germans, and of course for veterans of the German army, for veterans of the Waffen SS. The Waffen SS veterans had created a large number of local veterans groups, which eventually merged into a single national veterans lobby to lobby for the interests of Waffen SS veterans, and particularly after the Korean War breaks out in 1950, and the discussion about rearming West Germany and then possibly making West Germany part of NATO, part of the alliance. The question of the fate of war criminals enters into this. The German army and Waffen SS veterans are saying to the West German political establishment, we won't support a new West German army when our comrades who have been unjustly persecuted and convicted are in prison. So there is a Cold War dimension to this, most definitely. In London and in Washington in particular, there is a clear awareness that this is that the fact that there are war criminals in prison is a real problem. And Norman Gota, of course, has written about this in the case of Spandau prison and the convicted men in the main Nuremberg trial. And the controversy over the fate of the Malmedy men is another dimension to this problem, right? Mm. What happens to the convicted men? And ultimately, as I described in the book, the solution is not a legal one. For a long time, the advocates of the convicted men have been pressing for legal solutions, for retrial. Or they had demanded that the Americans overturn the verdicts. Instead, what we get is a series of parole and clemency boards. And so this was more of had a legal dimension to it, but this was more of a political solution than a purely legal one. So throughout the first half of the 1950s, the convicted men are paroled and have their sentences reduced. And by the beginning of 1956, or 1957, every last convicted man in the Malmedy case is freed.
Good. That leads us to my last question about the book. In your mind, what is the legacy of this trial in this case?
Well, I think there are a couple of legacies. As I described in the book, the controversy surrounding the case produces the second major United States Senate investigation into interrogation methods. The first followed the U.S.-Philippine War in 1902. The second was the Malmedy case, and the third was the more recent Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, the so-called Feinstein Committee. And the Malmedy investigation was conducted by a subcommittee of the Senate Armed Services Committee. And an informal member of that committee was Joseph McCarthy. And McCarthy was at that time not really nationally known. This was before his infamous speech in West Virginia. And his political career was really going down the tubes. And he saw an opportunity, I think, to really make a splash. And he had before him copies of these translated affidavits and newspaper stories, and he thought this was an open and shut case. These kids had been tortured by American interrogators, and the Army was trying to cover it up. And, he makes a complete fool of himself in committee hearings and eventually storms out, accusing the Army of making a covering up abuse. But he doesn't know what he's talking about. If you read the transcript of the hearings, he's hopelessly confused. And in part because he's going up against the former interrogators themselves, and he's absolutely no match. He's no match for William Pearl. He's no match for these people. But you asked me about the legacy, so here's my point. The Army officials, the investigators, the prosecutors, these men aren't famous then or now. They weren't particularly powerful. They defended their institution. They defended the Army. They defended their record. They stood up for the truth. They stood up to a lying demagogue, as did, I should add, the American senator who presided over the Senate investigation itself. He stood up to a demagogue in his own party. And I think that's one of the legacies. I think another one is that this is a story involving what we now call fake news, or this is the history of the Mount Mady controversy is a story that we're involving what we would now call fake news. The press really fell down on the job, I have to say, in this case, the press in the United States, the press in Western Germany. One of the reasons the former investigators were so angered by the torture stories was that no one was asking them before the Senate investigation. No one was asking them for their side of the story. They were simply presenting these horrible stories and giving the clear impression that they were true and that the Army was desperately trying to cover up this terrible business. But nobody was talking to the interrogators. And some of them were still active duty, so they were very constrained in what they could say. But most of them, including William Pearl, were not. They had gone back into civilian life. And they mobilized in advance of the Senate hearings, and it's a good thing that they did so. They mobilized to defend their records, and especially when McCarthy was involved. It was a good thing that they really came prepared to the hearings.
Fascinating. And before we let you go, first I want to say to all our listeners, this is a really great book. You should definitely go out and read it. But before I let Dr. Remen go, I'd like to ask, what are you working on now?
Well, now I'm changing, shifting gears considerably. I am starting to work on a big book about armed conflict in the imperial world, as I call it, from roughly the late 19th century through the period of decolonization. So it's not going to be specifically a book about Germany or Germany in the United States or the occupation, but a book with a much wider scope. And I've been teaching some courses on the subject, and like the Mount Mady book, it's one of those topics that it gets its hooks into you and really won't let go. So that's what I'm working on now.
Well, that sounds like a fascinating project, and I'd love to have you back on the show to talk about it. I really want to thank you again for agreeing to be on the show, and I want to thank everybody for listening, and we will see you next time.